Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine.
A new epic. Dubbed a Yellowstone origin story, to remind fans that it's a way-back prequel to the bigger show on cable, 1883 might seem closer in tone and scope to A Lonesome Dove or an Into the West. The new series, which debuted in late December, is truly epic and has the creative energy and character building of Taylor Sheridan to fuel it. That's certainly a good thing for CNI readers, many of you Yellowstone fanatics who have no doubt subscribed to the Paramount Plus streaming network just to be in front and center for 1883. And if you aren't familiar with the new prequel yet, allow Paramount to fill you in a little more. It follows the Dutton family as they embark on a journey west through the Great Plains toward the last bastion of untamed America. It's a stark retelling of Western expansion and an intense study of one family fleeing poverty to seek a better future in America's promised land, Montana. Country superstars Tim McGraw and Faith Hill, the brilliant Sam Elliott, Isabel May, and LaMonica Garrett lead a large ensemble cast, also featuring the likes of Billy Bob Thornton, Martin Sinsmeyer, Audie Rick, and Mark Rissman. If you are in on the action of 1883, be sure to visit cowboysandindians.com each morning following the premiere of a new episode. There will be spirited recaps. And if you aren't watching yet, well, what's the holdup? Sam Elliott's in it, for goodness sake.
Back to the ranches. If you're hoping for adventure at a guest ranch this upcoming summer, it's never too early to get your plans in order. Let these previous stays in Montana, Arizona, and Colorado guide you. Circle Bar Guest Ranch, Utica, Montana. It's the cool dawn of a summer day in Montana, and the cowboys at the Circle Bar Guest Ranch are driving in the horses from their overnight pasture. The Palominos, Buckskins, Paints, and other colorful horses are like an artist's palette as the energetic herd trots in, driven by a handful of wranglers decked out in traditional cowboy regalia. Looks like a scene out of a Charlie Russell painting. Charlie would feel right at home. In fact, this still pristine part of central Montana was Russell's home. The man, many consider the greatest Western artist of all time, spent the 1880s as a cowboy here in the Judith River Basin, a crystal-clear stream that flows right through the Circle Bar. And for 2 years, the team, then known as Kid Russell, stayed in a nearby cabin with mountain man Jake Hoover. The well-preserved log structure still stands today, and the Circle Bar will take you to see it. Charlie lived here from 1880 to 1882, says tour guide Alice True, part of the True family that owns the ranch. He came here when he was 16, and Jake kind of took pity on him, and so he helped him get on his feet for a couple of years. Russell often painted scenes from his cowboy days here, including A Quiet Day in Utica, capturing a rowdy incident in the old frontier town you pass through on the way to the ranch. Just like Jake helped Charlie, the True family has put the Circle Bar back on its feet. Founded as a cattle ranch in the late 1800s, its landmark red barn was built in 1902. By the 1940s, the Circle Bar had become a popular dude ranch. Sarah Stevenson, first woman president of the Dude Ranchers Association, bought the ranch in the 1980s. However, the Circle Bar would later close and sat vacant for 12 years. The Trues, owners of the White Stallion Ranch in Tucson, brought the Circle Bar back to life in 2020. Sarah's son, Peter Holatz, and his wife, Sabine, worked hard to put the ranch back in order and then sold it to us, says owner Russell True. They handed over a beautiful ranch in a great location with virtually unlimited and varied riding. Our family is so fortunate to have the opportunity to bring back one of America's historic dude ranches. Guests are so glad they did. The scenery is just incredible, says Nevada guest Chelsea Fry, soaking in the surroundings during a leisurely trail ride. It far exceeded my expectations, says her mother, Misty Summers. 85 miles southeast of Great Falls, the Circle Bar sits at the base of seemingly uncounted acres of national forest and other public lands. You'll ride most any kind of western terrain you can imagine, including wide open country. We don't have to go nose to tail, says the Circle Bar's Linda Knox. We can spread out and go cross country. Fast rides are available for the experienced, and lessons can help improve your riding skills. But the vast majority of people just want to relax on a horse, says Knox. They just want to have something that's going to go down the trail. I expected it to be beautiful up here, but it is unbelievable, says Pamela Reynolds, riding with her granddaughters. Pamela and her 10 or so family members are all staying in the big ranch house that's available for large groups. There are rustic cabins scattered across the property, some within earshot of the soothing Judith River. Or you can book a suite in the western-flavored Main Lodge. That's where you'll gather for hearty family-style meals and get up to speed about all there is to do. Horses are the heart of the ranch, but there's also fishing, hiking, archery, trap shooting, and e-bikes to explore the quiet back roads of this remote and beautiful area. Charlie would likely prefer the Circle Bar's cattle drives or driving in the horses with the Wranglers. The peaceful view from the saddle hasn't changed much since the days Russell rode this country. But a soothing stay at the Circle Bar may be an experience those living in our frantic age need more than ever. White Stallion Ranch, Tucson, Arizona. It's August outside Tucson. Today, the city's official temperature will hit 110 degrees. It might be the last place you'd think of going for a summer horseback vacation. But for the guests who've come from all over the world to the White Stallion Ranch, the weather is perfect. We love the heat, says Harmond Hausner, here from Germany for the 9th August in a row. In Germany, it's so cold. The White Stallion is a 3,000-acre oasis of pristine Old West Arizona. While you're just minutes from the outskirts of Tucson, drive through the ranch gate and it feels like you're a million miles away. That's because the ranch lies in a bowl surrounded by mountains, sharing a border with Saguaro National Park. Look at the right direction, and it's the same view Geronimo and Wyatt Earp might have seen. With Tucson's daily high summer temperature averaging right about 100 degrees, the White Stallion has long been a winter destination, closed during June, July, and August. But that changed in 2009 when the ranch went year-round, and guests are happy they did. Summer stays are especially popular with Europeans. The August we visited, there were guests from Sweden, Switzerland, Belgium, China, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. The home flag of every visitor is flown during their stay. I get a kick out of that, shares white stallion owner Russell True. Our little dude ranch out in the Arizona desert, we might have 8 different countries here at one time. Americans are here too. Eric Christensen came over from San Diego with his 2 young sons. If I did this in Southern California, it'd be triple the price, he explains, and 20 times the people. The White Stallion offers a summer discount off their peak season rates, and True says a summer stay can be half of the cost of a peak season visit to a northern dude ranch in Wyoming or Montana. We were surprised how much riding we do, even though it's this hot, says British guest Simon Turner. We thought maybe 2 hours a day, but we're getting 3-4 hours a day. Summer is monsoon season, and desert thunderstorms and sunsets can be spectacular. But the weather seldom interferes with rides, which are scheduled early and late in the day to avoid the worst of the heat. Calm weather and warm evenings allow for outdoor dining on the hacienda-style patio. Family-style meals make it easy to meet and mingle and share dinner with new friends all over the world. So what to do when you're not riding? There's no shortage of options. The pool is a popular place, and the ranch offers a variety of afternoon activities in its air-conditioned Longhorn meeting room. You can learn about this area's fascinating Native American history, complete with the chance to handle authentic, ancient stone-grinding tools. Or you can try your hand at carving leather and get a taste of what's involved in building a saddle or a pair of chaps. There's also a weekly horsemanship demonstration, and since you're on vacation, it's okay to enjoy an afternoon nap. The White Stallion's adventure package includes rock climbing on the peaks surrounding the ranch, power-assisted fat-tire e-bikes, and target shooting using a single-action cowboy-style 22 pistol and a Winchester-style lever-action 22 rifle. They want to taste riding, but what if it isn't their thing, says Russell. Then they're reassured by the other options. Regardless of riding skill, though, the White Stallion has the horses and the rides to keep everyone happy. The ranch keeps about 150 horses, mounts that fit riders of every size and ability. The ranch attracts a lot of accomplished equestrians. Fast rides with long lopes on the trail are a favorite. You can also take the breaks off chasing cows in the big arena during the ever-popular team pinning. Daily lessons can get new or rusty riders up to speed in a hurry. And the relaxed atmosphere of Western hospitality that pervades this place makes it easy to learn. It's the easy ambience, says Jeff Kelleher, back again from San Diego. It puts you at ease in a situation where you'd normally tend not to be at ease. Some ranch rides include adventurous climbs into the mountains that border the property. There are unforgettable views at the top. It's enough to make you forget about the heat, which you get used to in short order. Rainbow Trout Ranch, Antonito, Colorado. It's a summer Saturday hot night high in the Colorado Rockies where a memorable week at Rainbow Trout Ranch is coming to an end. It's the last night of an escape from a troubled world into a rustic refuge that sits at 9,000 feet along the Conejos River, just north of the New Mexico border. We've enjoyed days horseback in this unspoiled remnant of the American West, casting pristine waters for the colorful fish for the ranch is named after, and hiking to watch the sunrise from a mountain peak. Flavoring all that adventure is the carefree summer camp atmosphere of this special place, a tone set by the warm and gracious Iowa family that makes it all happen. From the very first time I came in the late 90s, I just felt like I'd known them all my life, says longtime guest Nancy Jane Butler, here from Arkansas. Three generations of the Van Berkum family bring this century-old ranch to life. Doug and Linda Van Berkum, their son David and his wife Jane, and a host of third-generation family members. It was fun having them here when they were little kids, says Doug of his grandchildren, many of whom now spend summers working at the ranch. I don't have to tell them to do stuff. They just know it has to be done. Founded as a fishing retreat in 1926 by a Texas oil family looking to escape the summer heat, the property was perfect for the Dude Ranch the Van Berkums envisioned. But making that dream come true took a lot of work. There wasn't a fence that could hold a horse, says Doug. So we fenced like mad and cleaned the place. Today, Rainbow Trout's main lodge is like a cathedral made of logs, as polished and beautiful as a classic car. It's a marvel to explore the massive room where Doug's artfully displayed Western memorabilia collection adds to the cowboy ambience. The surrounding cabins date from the same era. But Rainbow Trout is an outdoor vacation, and the Rocky Mountain High Country horseback experience is the star attraction, all done cowboy style. The wranglers dress the part, complete with chaps. We try to make this feel like the old West, but with some amenities, says Doug, always in jeans and boots, topped off with a cowboy hat. We have a pool, that kind of stuff, but I think they expect us to be Western. With the kids safely supervised, Mom and Dad can embark on their own adventures. On her second visit from Chicago, Kelly Costello has taken advantage of the opportunity to discover fly fishing. Last year was my first year of fly fishing, she says, and they're very patient with us newbies. Guide McCray Stevens stands in the stream alongside Kelly. I just try to help people have a great time on the water, he says. A successful day is watching them grow as an angler and pick up the passion for fly fishing. A mile of river runs through the ranch, which is surrounded by uncounted miles of riding trails of all kinds of terrain in the surrounding national forest. Want to mosey? Explore a steep mountain trail? Or kick your horse into a lope on the flats? Jane and her crew are happy to oblige. Jane goes out of her way for people to get the kind of ride they would want, says Doug. Sometimes we'll have 15 people riding, and we'll have 8 rides going out. Jasmine Spear Johnson, a pioneering woman on the Wyoming frontier, made her place in history with a camera. By Tempe Javits. In the little village of Bighorn, Wyoming, on September 11, 1886, Jasmine Spear was born to pioneer parents Willis and Belle Spear. Her love of photography began in 1897 when her mother Belle bought a glass plate Kodak camera. When Belle put that camera in Jasmine's 11-year-old hands, her life changed focus forever. Jasmine assisted her mother throughout her childhood in taking and developing photographs. Jasmine went to grade school in Bighorn and high school in Sheridan, then married cattle and sheep rancher Will Johnson in 1906. For Jasmine to find time to work with her photos often required great determination. Her love of creating images necessitated different priorities from the usual housewife and mother. During her lifetime, she raised 7 children, assisted her husband in running 3 different ranches, and finally, from 1930 until retirement in 1943, with the help of her husband and growing children, managed her father's Spiro Wigwam Dude Ranch in the Bighorn Mountains outside of Sheridan, Wyoming. unfortunately, her photographic contribution to the history of southeast Montana and northeast Wyoming has been mostly forgotten. Taking cues from her father's friend from Miles City, Montana, frontier and native life photographer L.A. Huffman, Jessamine concentrated first on her ranching life. Huffman took photos of the Spear Cattle Company's operations from 1905 to about 1915. Many of Jessamine's wide-ranging images of cattle herds and horses reflect an admiration for Huffman's technique. She also closely studied the paintings of Sheridan artist William Bill Golings, who had studied composition at the Chicago Academy of Art for 3 winters, while employed many summers by the Spear Brothers. To emphasize action, Golings' cowboy and rodeo subjects entirely filled the space in his paintings. Jessamine paid close attention to his skillful compositions and began moving in on her subjects. Two photographer friends, Charles Belden of Meteetse, Wyoming, and Fred Miller, clerk at the Crow Reservation, were comrades with cameras. Belden's photos inspired several of Jessamine's takes on similar subjects, and they exchanged ideas on how best to color some of their black and white images. Belden's photo, Call of the Range, inspired Jessamine to capture a photo of a bawling bull. Her photo, Montana Roundup, was produced as a travel poster for the Northern Pacific Railway. Miller and Jessamine shared photos and a personal interest in the everyday life of the Crow people. Jessamine and husband Will leased many acres for summer pasture from the Crow and Cheyenne tribes, and she became close friends with many of the families they leased land from. She was in the right place at the right time to meet and discuss with other local artists and photographers lessons on perspective, composition, use of light and shadow, horizontal and vertical lines to accentuate her subjects, and the search for that simple background to highlight her subjects. Often leaving her kids in the care of their older sisters or the ranch cook, Jessamine preferred to be out riding the range with Will, her camera ever ready for the next action shot. "I rode horseback as wild as any of my children ever were," she wrote in her diary. "My father never permitted me to ask the men to saddle my horse for me. I had to wait on myself always. Grandpa drove a team of ponies hitched to his buckboard. They were called Buck and Johnny. Buck was buckskin in color with black mane and tail and a black stripe down his back. Johnny was a strawberry roan. I rode Johnny to school sometimes. He was my favorite horse. One time Ruth and Ruby Stevenson and I were riding Johnny, who shied and threw us into a lot of thorn bushes. We were very much scratched up, but we climbed right back on." The independent spirit cultivated in her youth would serve her well as an adult hunting for photographs on the Montana frontier. Her diaries reveal a woman both of her time and ahead of her time, working diligently at not just her craft, but at the business of it, fitting it into her domestic life and enlisting family to help with hearth and home and even her photography. Mother was always out helping father drive cattle, visiting Indians, or working over her photographs, her daughter Annabelle commented. "I helped raise my younger brothers and sisters. Phyllis baked bread, and I did most of the other cooking." Jessamine's diaries reveal a woman seemingly as dedicated to photography as to anything else in her life. Saturday, February 19th, 1921. "Last night, oldest daughter Annabelle was shown how to develop pictures, and when she got tired, I had to do it." Printed 127. Thursday, January 3rd, 1924. Miss Milne is visiting Mrs. Rugg and will come down and visit me a few days next week. I took her pictures I had colored. She was very much pleased with them. I also showed her my Kodak book of enlargements, and they were quite enthusiastic over them. Wednesday, January 23, 1924. Colored the pictures Marion Russell sent me in last night's mail. They're beautiful. Four enlargements and a lot of small pictures. Thursday, March 27, 1924. I believe I got some grand pictures today. We went through lots of snow. Selim, her horse, behaved like an angel and worked like a Trojan. When we came home, he snorted at the smell from the pig pen. She had been riding the north rosebud pasture. There were four cows or heifers with tiny calves. One just born was carried by one of the cowboys on Prince. The entry from Friday, January 25th, 1924, simply reads, colored pictures all day. Though color photography was attempted as early as the 1840s, color film would not become widely available and affordable till the 1950s. In the absence of colored film, the popularity of color images gave rise to the art of hand coloring monochrome prints. Jessamine often hand-colored her photos using oil pencils and oil colors. I had the Sheridan Studio color some pictures of the children about 4 years ago, and I asked them how they did it. She wrote in a letter from February 1928. They got me a box of colors, and I started out to color pictures myself. Self-taught and fearless in learning new things, she became quite accomplished at it. Eventually, cowboy photographer Charles Belden would hire her to color some of his black and white images. It was more than Jessamine's well-practiced skills and tomboyish adventureness that combined to distinguish her photography. She, in fact, had a photographer's eye, coupled with a special warmth and love for her subject matter. Her photography embraced her love of cattle, sheep, and dude ranching, the local Little Bighorn and Cook battlefields, landscapes and wildlife, her Crow and Northern Cheyenne neighbors, rodeos, and the wonders of the Bighorn Mountains. Jessamine's ease with the people in her portraits, the emotional depth of her feeling for the land and its history, drew people to her images during her lifetime and continue to do so today. Her viewpoint was sensitive, accessible, and feminine. She paid attention and photographed how women were more and more involved on a daily basis in running the local ranches. She also had access to the Crow and Cheyenne women because she knew them and she was a woman. Some of her photos are actually on the woman's side of the teepee, a rare perspective that indicate access a male photographer would have found near impossible. Over time, Jessamine forged her own independent vision and created an individual style that not only reflected her artistic sensibilities, but conveyed her personal insight into the advancements and challenges faced by the ranching and reservation communities of southeastern Montana and northeastern Wyoming from the 1910s through the early 1950s. With little formal training and with a critical eye, she produced an unforgettable legacy of 16,000-plus images to delight and inspire future generations of photographers. Jessamine's photos, letters, and diaries are currently held by her son Tori's descendants, who are exploring an appropriate future home for the collection.
Hello, this is Michael. I am reading from the archives of True West Magazine, January-February 1978 edition. The Great Blizzard of 1889. Howling out of the north in November, it was several months early and caught the Southwest unprepared, by Ruth W. Armstrong. January 1977 was the most severe winter on record for much of the northeastern part of the United States. And 88 years ago, a blizzard of similar proportions swept the cattle country of northeastern New Mexico, slicing out into Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. For 8 straight days, it howled, trapping cowboys, sheep herders, livestock, and railroad cars wherever they might be. On the 9th day, it began to let up, but weeks passed before all of the livestock carcasses were uncovered. Men lost their lives, too. The most unusual feature of the storm was its timing. It hit unexpectedly the first week in November, a month that is usually mild and sunny. As far as the cattlemen were concerned, November was the worst time of year it could have happened. This was during the roundup, when cowboys were combing the thousands of acres of unfenced mountain and high plateau ranges in northeastern New Mexico. If the storm had hit in midwinter, cattle would have already been shipped to market. Unsold herds would have been in winter pastures where trees and canyon walls provided protection, and the cowboys and sheep herders would have been laid off or holed up for the slow season. Manly M. Chase had extensive ranching operations in New Mexico from 1867 to 1915. He was a major stockholder, officer, usually treasurer, and in some cases, general manager of the Cimarron Cattle Company, Gila Cattle Company, Red River Cattle Company, Monte Ruvalto Cattle Company, Maxwell Cattle Company, Chase, Dawson, and Malding, and the Luera Cattle Company. These companies handled from 60,000 to 100,000 head of cattle and around 50,000 head of sheep annually during the years of their biggest operations. Their holdings ran from the Colorado-New Mexico border to the San Augustine Plains of central New Mexico, covering hundreds of thousands of acres. Chase was instrumental in introducing high-grade Herefords into New Mexico, fencing parts of the ranges, and for raising cattle and sheep at the same time. The following description of the blizzard of 89 is from his scrapbook of newspaper clippings of that year. November 8th, Springer, New Mexico. Unless the snowstorm, which has been raging for 8 days, comes to an end soon, next summer we'll see a country covered with the dead bodies of animals as thickly as was the old Santa Fe Trail in the 60s. The depth of snow is now not less than 25 inches on the level, and in many places has drifted 7 feet high. When the storm struck this section near Cimarron, 7 large herds of cattle, numbering from 400 to 2,000, were being held near this place awaiting shipment to eastern markets. The rain of a week ago was followed Thursday morning by blizzards of snow and sleet, which sent the herds in a southerly direction. In vain did the already half-frozen cowboys try to check the march of the herds. On they went through the increasing storm until, finding it utterly impossible to hold the cattle, the cowboys rode aside and let them pass. Then, when nearly dead, the cowboys rode the exhausted horses into canyons or partially sheltered places where they passed many hours of misery without food or fire. 2 cowboys wandered into a canyon where they found a cedar tree in which was a rat's nest. They managed to light a fire with this. During the second night, one of their horses died from cold, and having nothing to eat, the man cut from the animal pieces of flesh, which they warmed and ate without salt. After being in the canyon for more than 60 hours, they started out, and after much suffering and hardship from their weakened condition, managed to reach the ranch 30 miles away, where they were cared for. 5 cowboys and 2 sheep herders are known to be frozen to death. 2 men coming in this morning report the drifts in some places as 7 and 8 feet high, and containing hundreds of dead stock, many of the animals with the horns and heads above the snow. In one drift, 13 cattle were counted, in another, 10. Some of these were alive, but unable to move from their frigid prison. Herds of sheep are completely wiped out of existence, and the range, for 30 miles from town, is covered with dead carcasses. It is estimated that 20,000 sheep have perished in this part of the territory. The hay supply is nearly exhausted, and today, $100 per ton was offered by stockmen. At Texline, 9 miles below Clayton, New Mexico, two passenger trains have been snowbound for a week. Provisions are running out, and the passengers are compelled to venture out into the storm and kill cattle, the quarters of which are taken into the cars and roasted for food. It is thought the snowplow will reach the imprisoned trains tomorrow and release them, and that the road will be open in a day or two. The storm is by far the worst ever known in New Mexico. Next paragraph. November 9th, 1889, Clayton, New Mexico. The storm has abated, and for the first time in 9 days, the sun is shining. While no authentic reports have been received concerning the loss of life, reports have come from inland that several sheep herders have been frozen on the Leon, a small creek 20 miles south of town. No communications from the 7 inland post offices have been received. Some apprehension is felt for the tramper's mail driver, who should have reached Canyon yesterday, but has not yet appeared. Telegrams tell of Joe Martin, a cowboy, who with others was employed in holding a herd of cattle. His horse gave out with him, leaving him on the prairie 8 miles from the nearest house. This he endeavored to reach, but was overpowered and frozen after walking a short distance. The trainmen report much difficulty in different cuts, which in some places are completely filled with dead cattle and sheep. Stock will be unable to live for any length of time, and unless the cold weather moderates and the crust which has formed on the snow loosens, mortality among cattle will be extensive. Several cowboys who drifted off with herds have not been heard from, and rescuing parties who are looking for them will return tomorrow. Next paragraph. November 11, 1889, Trinidad, Colorado. The present snowstorm is without doubt the worst that has ever fallen in this section at this time of the year, and the damage to property will be very great. Hundreds of cattle, sheep, and horses are no doubt frozen up on the plains, and stockmen who are shut out from town and cut off from provisions are suffering from cold and for want of food to just keep them alive. Judd Lyon of Raton, inspector for the Northern New Mexico Stock Growers Association, came up today from Texline, Texas, and tells a harrowing tale of the suffering being undergone by the people living in the territory south of here, while no one is in a position to render them assistance. He says 14 men are known to have frozen to death in the neighborhood of Clayton and Folsom, and that when the storm has passed and search can be instituted, the number will reach 50. Many of the settlers who have moved into northeastern New Mexico in the past 18 months are nearly destitute, and if the snow continues to fall much longer, many a poor family will perish for want of fuel and food. As far as I have been able to learn, no photographs exist that record this blizzard, the devastated countryside and the devastated people. Only the pages of small-town newspapers preserve its memory. True West Magazine, February 1964 edition. Man of the Old West. A young boy learns that the true measure of a man is not made by the number of years he has lived or the account of hair he has left on his head. Men, like books, cannot be judged by their covers. By James E. Harvey. When I was a kid, I knew some interesting men of 60 or 65, and I liked to listen to those old fellows talk. They had roamed the West when it was really wild. They were different from men of their same age today. Those old men had lived in the open, hit the rough spots, and led a hard, rugged life. Any young punk who tried to push one of them around made a sorry mistake. They weren't easy. Louis Flegel was such a man. I lived with my family 15 miles west of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Louis ran a sawmill near us. I went to work for him when I was a little past 14. Like most boys, I thought I knew just about everything worth knowing. But Louis taught me a lesson that has stayed with me all these years. It is good to be careful about passing judgment on a man. There is always a chance that you can be wrong. Before Louis got through with me, I began to wonder if I really was right about anything. Louis was a big man and bald, except for a fringe of hair, which was snow white, like his long chin whiskers. His clear blue eyes had a look of confidence, and he spoke sharp and to the point when he set me straight on something. I immediately took a dislike to him and thought he was about as crummy an old man as I ever had the misfortune to meet. I even considered slapping his face, but decided he was so old it would be a shame to jump him. Then one day, I went down in the saw pit with a shovel to clean out some sawdust. The big circular saw was running overhead. Louis followed and dragged me out by the collar. I tried to break away and fight back, but that vice-like grip held, and he grabbed me by the seat of the pants and the nape of the neck and gave me a heave that sent me rolling. He stood there shaking his finger at me. "What are you trying to do?" he stormed. "Get your fool head cut off? Never go in that pit again till the saw is stopped." From then on, I forgot about jumping Louis. I didn't want him to get a hold of me again. He was like a bear. As time went by, he proved to be right time and again, and always kept his word. Gradually, my feeling toward him began to change, and I felt sorry for the old fellow. He had to work so hard. Many things went wrong around the mill, and he always took the blame. When equipment broke down or someone caused trouble, he'd say, "Fine mess." That was all. I often told my folks, "That old guy is going to kill himself. He's doing enough work around that mill to wear out a young guy." My dad would just laugh. "Don't worry about Louis," he'd say. "He can take care of himself." Louis proved that to me about a year later. The sawmill had been shut down all winter. Spring had come, but snow still lay in the drifts. Louis came along one day on horseback, leading a saddle pony. He asked me to go on a trip with him. He was going over on the Dry Fork to see Ed Davis about running the saw for the coming summer, and would be gone 2 or 3 days. Mother put us up a lunch, and we left. I looked him over as we rode along, his loggers laced boots, Louis tucked inside of him, red shirt open at the neck, an old and slouchy felt hat. "Too bad he's so old," I thought. As the sun sank behind the timber-covered mountains, we rode into Ed's place. It was just a big log house, with a barn and some corrals by a small creek. To me, the sight was depressing. The yard was strewn with junk, old lumber and tin cans. A broken-down wagon was nearby. Windows were broken out of the house. The place had an abandoned look. We dismounted and went inside, as the door was not locked. The floor was covered with rubbish, and the room smelled of rats. An old cook stove sat near the door, and in one corner was a wooden bunk with what was left of a mattress. The cupboard was bare. "Fine mess," Louis muttered. "You said it," I thought, and boy, was I hungry. At the barn, we had better luck. There was hay in the loft for our horses. After feeding them, we returned to the house, my spirits at low ebb. I was worried mostly about Louis. Having to go to bed without any supper was liable to make an old guy sick after a hard day's ride. Lewis rummaged around and finally found a piece of candle, which he lit and set on the table when darkness settled over the country. He swept the junk out of the house with an old broom and dusted the mattress. Then we sat on the bunk and he told stories of his life in the Old West when he was young. Believe me, I listened. That old man had been places and done things. The candle burned low and went out. We lay down on the bunk, but I was too hungry to sleep. It was a long night as I lay and listened to Lewis snore, and then when it seemed I had only dozed off, he shook me. "Come, Jimmy," he said. "I've got the horses all saddled and ready to go." The sun was shining, and I noticed Lewis's gray pony was streaked with dust. The sorrel I rode didn't look much better. We mounted and hit the trail again. "Bill Wilson lives beyond those mountains yonder," Lewis pointed to some dark timbered mountains in the distance. "He's a good sawyer. We will go by and see him. It's not much out of our way." Somehow the idea gave me a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, and a sense of foreboding came over me. "Suppose we find this guy gone, too?" Lewis looked at me searchingly. "You sick?" he asked. "No," I said. "I'm fine." "It's only about 20 miles," Lewis added cheerfully. Along in the afternoon, we were riding through flat, rolling sagebrush country. A big timber hawk flew up out of the brush, circled, and lit in a dead tree nearby. "She's got a nest somewhere," Lewis said. "I'm going to find it." He dismounted and hunted around through the brush, and sure enough, he found her nest. There were two eggs about the size of a hen egg. "Can you eat a hawk egg, Jimmy?" "You bet I can, Mr. Flegel. I could eat the hind leg of a coyote. Shoot that old hawk and cook her, too. I'm hungry." "I tried a hawk once, long time ago," Lewis smiled. "I didn't like it." He went below a snowdrift, got some mud, and packed the eggs in it, built a sagebrush fire, let it burn down, and roasted the eggs and the coals. When he took them out and peeled off the baked mud, they peeled like they had been boiled. I ate part of mine, and I got a taste out of that egg. Oh boy, in fancy, I can taste it yet. Maybe some of you have sometimes been up in an old loft or some place where there was a strong, moldy smell. That's the way that egg tasted. I laid the other half down. Again, Lewis gave me that searching look. "Sick?" he asked. "No," I answered, as I wiped the sweat from my face with my sleeve. "But if I eat the rest of that egg, I sure will be. You're welcome to it if you want it." He picked up my part, still eyeing me. Lewis knew good and well that I was about all in. After he ate the egg, he just sat cross-legged, his lace boots battered and scarred, and poked at the dying fire with a stick for some time. Then those clear blue eyes rested on me again. "Do I still shoot that old hawk and cook her, Jimmy?" he asked. "Not unless you want to eat her," I said. "I've had all the hawk I want." He smiled and rose to his feet. "Come, let's go." Before long, we were in the mountains Lewis had pointed to. Timber, underbrush, fallen logs and boulders. Some of the ground was so rough and steep, we had to walk and lead our ponies. Soon I was all in and lagging. I had quit feeling sorry for Lewis and was worrying about myself. Time and again, the old man stopped and waited for me to catch up. "It's not much farther," he'd say by way of encouragement. Darkness was settling over the country when we rode up to the top of a ridge and looked down on a big log house, some corrals, and a log barn. This place, too, had a dilapidated, deserted look, and my spirits fell. The house was full of rubbish, as the other one had been, but this time there was no bunk or stove. The place smelled of skunks. Lewis struck a match and looked around. "Fine mess," he said. I kept quiet. I felt sick and wished I were home. There was no hay for our horses. During a miserable night I thought would never pass, I lay on the floor awake and listened to Lewis snore. I heard small animals in the house and was scared stiff. I once knew a man who had got bitten by a skunk and died of hydrophobia. I didn't want that to happen to me. I nudged Lewis with my elbow a few times. He quit snoring and asked, "What do you want?" "Skunks in the house," I told him. "Go back to sleep and don't worry. They won't bother you." Soon he was snoring again, and I found myself hoping I would be a tough old guy like Lewis when I became his age. Nothing ever seemed to bother him. I wondered if I could ever make it home. It would take 2 more days, I reasoned, and 2 more days, like the past 2, would just about finish me. At daybreak, we were on our way again. "We are heading for home," Lewis announced as we rode along. "We will go by Crawford's coal camp on Deep Creek. It's a little farther, but we can make it tonight. It's always closed for the winter, but I think we will find something to eat there." "I hope so," I said weakly. "I could eat something all right." He seemed a little anxious. "You all right, Jimmy?" "Yeah," I bluffed. "I feel fine." Along in the afternoon, I could see high, timber-covered mountains ahead. "Crawford's is beyond those mountains," Lewis pointed, and my heart sank. More brush and fallen logs. More steep country, walking and leading. Late in the afternoon, we were in those mountains, and it was just about what I expected. About dusk, we rode into the Crawford coal camp. The cookhouse was not locked, and there were plenty of groceries. Ham, bacon, flour, syrup. At the barn, we found hay for our worn-out horses. After we cared for them, we returned to the house, and Lewis went about baking biscuits and frying ham and bacon. He whistled as he worked. I marveled at him because I was too tired to talk, let alone whistle. At home the next day, Lewis told my folks of our trip. "Fine mess," he concluded. "How did Jim stand it?" my dad asked. Lewis looked at me and smiled. "Just fine," he answered. "You old liar," I thought. "You know better than that." I felt ashamed of myself when I thought of the bad opinion I had once held of him, and how I had treated him. I made up my mind I'd try to be as good a man someday as Lewis Flegel. One thing I learned for sure on that trip 60 years ago, if a man is a top guy and some people treat him like he is poison, he need not worry. Just let them go their length. There's nothing they can do or say to hurt him. And they will change, just as I did. As I got to know him better, I liked him better. One of his sayings was, "Be honest. Live today so that you can live tomorrow." True West Magazine, January 2022 edition. Billy the Kid, Gunfighters and Rewards by Marshall Trimble. Question. During a film class on Western films, it was observed while watching the film The Gunfighter, a main character was wearing one spur throughout the movie. Back in the real West days, did a cowboy, or in the case of the movie, a town marshal, wear one spur as a normal matter of dress, or was one spur an exception and 2 spurs the normal? John Chase, Walla Walla, Washington. Spurs are used to communicate commands to your horse. A slight touch of the spurs can urge it to pick up the pace, move to the side, turn, or settle down. Spurs also can help a horse focus on the rider and its task. It is unusual to see someone wearing only one spur, but there's nothing that says you have to wear 2. Question. Was the Griswold and Gunnison revolver made in .32 and .36 calibers? Emil Karlsson, Västernpodden, Sweden. Everything I know and have seen concerning the Griswold and Gunnison revolver says it was a 36 caliber. It was produced for the Confederate Army and was almost an exact copy of the 1851 Colt 36 percussion cap and ball revolver, except it had a brass frame instead of steel. This was because of the scarcity of metals in the South. The company was able to produce only about 3,600 pieces before the factory was destroyed during Sherman's campaign through Georgia in 1864. Question: was Billy the Kid a bank robber, and why did he kill so many men? Nick Johnson, Springfield, Missouri. No, Billy never robbed a train or held up a bank. If you're talking about BTK killing 21 men, one for every year of his life, that was hogwash. Billy killed 4 men on his own and was a participant in 5 more. Considering the times and the fact that a war was going on in Lincoln County, that isn't many, relatively speaking. Question: was it common for axle nuts on wagons, carts, and stagecoaches to be secured with left-hand threads, with the thinking that left-hand threads would tend to tighten as the axle shaft turned, rather than loosen turning right? Spencer Ward, Gaithersburg, Maryland. Doug Hansen of the Hansen Wheel and Wagon Shop in Letcher, South Dakota, is the expert on anything to do with horse-drawn wagons. He says, correct, left-hand threads on the left side of the wagon to tighten as the wagons move forward. Question: how was reward money collected in the Old West? Frank Farmer, Dallas, Texas. Different entities paid bounties. For example, the government paid a bounty on army deserters, but it was so cheap that few civilians made the effort. Back in the 1830s, the Mexican government paid a bounty on Apache scalps, 100 pesos for a male, 50 for a female, and 25 for a child. Wells Fargo paid a bounty on stage and train robbers who robbed the express cars and stages. The Pinkertons paid bounties on outlaws who robbed their customers. Missouri Governor Thomas Crittenden placed a bounty on Jesse James. It was a tough business, and there were few bounty hunters, as they are portrayed in the movies. Most bounties and rewards were collected by duly authorized lawmen. Question: was Wells Spicer a judge or a justice of the peace? Doug Stidvent, Tucson, Arizona. Wells Spicer was a justice of the peace. A justice of the peace is a judge of a court of limited jurisdiction, a magistrate or a quasi-judicial official with certain statutory or common law magisterial powers. Proceedings involving justices of the peace are often faster and less formal than those in other courts. During a trial, the justice of the peace will hear and weigh evidence, then deliver a final decision, and, if a defendant is convicted, impose a sentence. Marshall Trimble is Arizona's official historian and the Wild West History Association's vice president. His latest book is 2018's Arizona Oddities, A Land of Anomalies and Tamales. Send your question with your city, state of residence to marshall.trimble@scottsdalecc.edu, or write Ask the Marshal, P.O. Box 8008, Cave Creek, Arizona, 85327.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.